Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, March 4th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Mendocino College announces new vocational nursing program starting next semester. Outcry over Redway tree cutting spurs Board of Supervisors' response. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
Mendocino College announced they are growing their healthcare education department by launching a new vocational nursing, or VN, program at their Ukiah campus. Before, this program was offered through the Ukiah Adult School. By transitioning the program to Mendocino College, costs have reduced. This will also help the current registered nursing, or RN, program that the school already has, giving students multiple pathways forward in their career. KMUD talked with Leslie Kleine-Darby, the director of the vocational nursing program at Mendocino College. She went over the program, what students should expect, and the timeline of the application process.
Our program is 3 semesters with 17 to 17 and a half units per semester. We don't run in the summers, so it will take about a year and a half to get through all the courses. But we provide an entry-level pathway into nursing, which students can do either before an RN program or completely separately from the RN program. We do not require any college-level prerequisites. So minimum prerequisites are to have a high school diploma or equivalency. And then students need to take the TEAS exam, spelled T-E-A-S, and pass at 54% or above. And it's the same exam as that the RN program also uses. So if students want to, they can apply for both programs just to increase their chances to get into a nursing program. Students are also required to attend a pre-application workshop. For this cohort, applications are due by the end of the day on March 13th. And so there's one available workshop left, which is on March 9th at 3:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. And that's hosted here at the college.
Darby explained the difference between the program before, when it was part of the Ukiah Adult School, and how this change will make the cost more affordable and give students more resources.
I was actually very excited that we were able to follow through and make this happen for our community. We had a good program at the Ukiah Adult School and some good support through the school district system. However, one reality with adult education is that it has to be financed completely through the students. We just didn't have a lot of alternative funding sources or financial aid availability for the students. And so we would either have to drastically keep increasing tuition, which no one was really excited about, that students would have to pay more. But it's been a long-time goal for several community members to get it to the college, and essentially that cuts tuition, or the total cost of the program, in approximately half than what it last was, since there's so many other financial aid availability and funding sources and grants available for our students. So that was a really incredible opportunity. And there's a lot more support at the college available for our students, the nursing students, need, such as the college's basic needs office and financial aid office. I know we have a lot more services, but those are that really have a really big impact in my brain.
She then explained the difference between the RN and VM programs offered.
Since it doesn't require college prerequisites, then really any RN program does. Students can, after they graduate from high school, if they know that nursing is the way that, you know, they want to go, then they can apply. They can either start their prerequisites for a registered nursing program, but with our program, as long as they pass the TEAS test, then they can just apply to our program, so potentially entering into nursing faster in a about a year and a half instead of 2 years for prerequisites and another two years for an associate's degree with a registered nursing. There's most of the skills are the same. However, there are some key differences. So one key difference is that registered nurses help or work with physicians and independently determine a care plan for the patients. And so both nurses, the VN and the RN, need to have good critical thinking skills, the RN is the one who makes those final determinations for patient care other than the physician or other provider. The vocational nurse helps to suggest a lot of options, but they're not the ones who make that final call. So they're more have a more collaborative role in decision making. And then another key difference comes down to what medications they can administer. LVNs can administer oral medications and injections, but they can't do anything through the IV unless they, after graduation, have a separate certification. And even then, it's limited in what they can give. Versus a registered nurse practices in more acute care settings, and so they can administer a wider range of medication.
The expected cost of this change will almost cut the price for the students in half, bringing the expected price to around $6,000, not including financial aid.
Before, our program was somewhere around $8,000 in tuition. I don't remember the exact number. But other program costs, a part of our program cost for both this program and the UKI Adult School includes the cost for testing and other associated costs to need to get through the program and obtain licensure after they graduate. So most of the after graduation costs don't change, but instead of everything at the adult school cost almost $13,000, so between $12,000 and $13,000, versus here it's just over $6,000, and then students can still get more financial aid to hopefully completely cover those costs.
The program picks the students via lottery. Hopeful students get lottery numbers based off their previous experience and location. The program is accepting 24 students in total. They are then going to do the lottery in 3 to 4 semesters for the next group of students.
Everyone who has a complete application will get one lottery ticket. And if I send all those numbers off to a different department, I say, here are all the numbers available in the lottery system. I send that off to a different department. They run it through a lottery number generator. They don't see names. They send me back a list with the numbers in which order that the lottery system picked. So then to determine those numbers, I assign everyone's name, how many numbers they get for their lottery application. So then I go just who's first on that list and keep going in order that list, and I pick out which numbers, or the first 24 numbers, compare those to which students have been selected. But then in addition, students can get extra lottery tickets. And I'm actually pulling up my list of there it is. So students can get one extra lottery number if they have an advanced or exemplary score on their TEAS test, or if they've taken both anatomy and physiology with a C or higher in the last 5 years. So that increases chances of admission. I also want to add, for the lottery numbers, students can get another two lottery numbers if they have their CNA certificate, or if they're a Mendocino or Lake County resident.
Lastly, she went over what students can expect over the 3 semesters in this new program.
They are going to be in the classroom and the skills lab and out in our clinical settings. The classes are 5 days a week every semester, but the hours vary slightly depending on which semester you're in. So Mondays and Tuesdays, just on a typical average day of the week, Mondays and Tuesdays are going to be roughly 5.5 hours of lecture time and other class activities, but in the classroom. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays are going to be either in the skills lab, learning some just basic nursing skills and integrating what we learned in the classroom into practice before we reach patients. And then we're going to take that knowledge and visit clinical sites, both in skilled nursing facilities and in the hospitals, and actually apply what we learned in the classroom and skills lab to caring for patients.
For more information, visit their website, www.mendocino.edu/LVN. Demands for accountability over the cutting of old-growth redwoods and lower redway are continuing, and the issue will soon be on the agenda of Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors. Daniel Mintz reports.
Community outcry over old-growth tree removal on private property in Lower Redway is not going away, and Humboldt's Board of Supervisors will soon be taking it up. Last winter, a homeowner cut down several old-growth redwood trees on his property on the corner of Bryceland Road and Oak Ridge Drive in Lower Redway. Supervisors heard objections to it during a public comment period last January and heard more at their March 3rd meeting. Residents of Redway and Southern Humboldt emphasized the importance of protecting the last of the county's old-growth redwoods and set a county Q-zone ordinance, a term describing an area with specific regulations, prohibits such cutting. The trees were reportedly cut to protect an on-site home, and the tree removals were approved by CAL FIRE, which allows exceptions to old-growth preservation in cases where structures are endangered. But Redway residents questioned why the county allowed it to happen and how such situations will be handled in the future, as said here by Sue Maloney.
I believe the landowner and CAL FIRE abused the exemption process. In addition to that, Humboldt County clearly failed to enforce its own ordinance. This never should have happened. The trees that were cut were all healthy, straight, and sound. They were not in danger of falling over. The only potential hazard was falling branches. Falling branches are not enough of a hazard to warrant taking entire old-growth trees. The county failed to perform its required duties by allowing this. The county has permitting authority that should have caused further scrutiny of this logging and avoided the destruction of these old growth trees. In the future, the county must not allow this to happen. It's pretty straightforward. Existing regulations simply need to be enforced. So the questions I have are, how did it happen that the Q zone was so easily circumvented, and what assurances will the county give that will convince us that this won't happen in the future?
Ettersburg residents John Harden and Amy Gustin described the cutting as an affront to community values, with Harden saying allowing sale of the redwood represents, quote, cynical opportunism, and Gustin saying the cutting is, quote, a real middle finger to the community. Other residents criticized the county's planning director, John Ford, and the planning department, but Southern Humboldt Supervisor Michelle Bushnell said Ford and the department weren't involved because the county shifted tree removal decision-making to CAL FIRE in response to litigation.
Currently, the process is on hold and is under review with the planning department. Director Ford had nothing to do with this. Exemption process came from this board, from a lawsuit that we got into with PG&E 2 years ago, and the planning department was directed by this board to do this from 2 years ago. So it has nothing to do with the planning department. I'm happy to talk to any of you. I don't think I've gotten an email from any of you. I know several of you. I'm happy to meet with you. When I became aware of this, I immediately called Director Ford, and I also immediately called CAL FIRE, and we had a meeting with CAL FIRE. We are working through the process to make this more transparent and to do what we can.
Some speakers noted that the homeowner who did the cutting is a CAL FIRE employee and suggested that bias is afoot. One speaker described the cutting as, quote, corruption enabled by John Ford and the planning department, who were happy to abandon their responsibilities and ignore a crime happening right in front of them. That drew a response from Supervisor Rex Bone, who said, quote, you lose any respect from me when you come up here and attack our staff. And he added that Ford had nothing to do with the cut, which, quote, never reached his desk. Before saying the matter should be taken up at a future meeting, Supervisor Steve Madrone spoke for the trees who can't.
We need to speak for the trees have no tongues. So we are speaking to you, board, at the top of our lungs. Unless someone like us cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. And so I would very much recommend that we agendize this item so we can have a full discussion about the Q zone, what happened here, and what we're going to be doing going forward.
In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In state news, viral videos may spur sales of oral nicotine pouches. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
New research suggests that viral TikTok videos about oral nicotine patches like Zyn may be driving a surge in sales in California and across the U.S. With 68% of American teens on TikTok, the fear is that more young people are at risk of starting to use these products. Researchers from Truth Initiative analyzed 10,000 videos from so-called Zinfluencers from 2021 to 2023, finding the market grew steadily and then accelerated after a spike in pouch-related content. Data show sales jumped from 12 million sold 1 month to 20 million the next. Megan Jacobs with Truth Initiative says nicotine can be very harmful to the still-developing teenage brain.
Nicotine use during adolescence can disrupt the circuits that control attention, learning, memory, and they can increase susceptibility to addiction, whether that's to nicotine or other drugs, including alcohol.
Health advocates add that about a decade ago, the U.S. saw a big surge in teenage vaping after a wave of viral videos marketed Juul brand vape pens to young people. A new study published in January in the journal Tobacco Control also found that sales of oral nicotine pouches went up alongside TikTok influencer videos and recommends stronger enforcement of regulations on social media to protect young people. Jacobs says Truth Initiative worked with Mayo Clinic to develop a digital tool called X Program to help people quit, free to anyone in the U.S. over age 13.
It provides interactive text message support, 24/7 access to tips, resources, evidence-based quitting strategies, and a community of really committed quitters helping ensure that everyone who wants to quit has the right resources in place to support them.
She adds X Program has been demonstrated to increase the odds of quitting by up to 40%, particularly among young people. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, Iran war disrupting humanitarian aid in Middle East, dividing allies and U.S. Congress. KPFA's Christopher Martinez reports.
The conflict in Iran and the Gulf region continues to spread, and the fallout is having effects beyond the Middle East. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council that the attacks broke the UN Charter. In Geneva, a spokesperson for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Ravina Shamdasani, spoke of the reported deadly attack on an Iranian girls' school.
I mean, children, little girls, in the middle of the school day, at the beginning of the school day, being killed in this manner, backpacks with, you know, blood stains on them. This is absolutely horrific. And I think if there's any image that captures the essence of the destruction, despair, and senselessness and cruelty of this conflict, those are the images.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the war is putting humanitarian supply lines across the Middle East under increasing strain. The World Food Program's regional director, Samer Abdeljaber, says tensions in the Red Sea and the Strait of Hormuz are driving up costs and delaying deliveries.
With seas contested and airspace closing, we're looking at adapting and relying our suppliers and use our supplier networks in other countries like Turkey, like Egypt, like Jordan and Pakistan to support overland corridors. and Egypt ports and Suez Canal are still functioning, and that is a key hub for us to support our operation in Gaza, but also in Sudan.
With fighting now also escalating in Lebanon, evacuations and airstrikes there have pushed some 30,000 people into shelters. But the disruptions from the war go even beyond that. The war has shown divisions among Western allies. President Donald Trump blasted the United Kingdom, and especially Spain, which denied the use of its bases for the attacks on Iran. Trump spoke to reporters during a meeting at the White House.
And now Spain actually said that we can't use their bases, and that's all right. We could use their base if we want. We could just fly in and use it. Nobody's going to tell us not to use it.
He announced an economic punishment for Spain.
So we're going to cut off all trade with Spain. We don't want anything to do with Spain.
That's a complicated move. Spain is a member of the European Union, 27 nations that trade as a bloc. So cutting trade with Spain would create tension with the other EU members. And there's more tension within the U.S., where the war has sparked debate and division. Opinion polls show the war being unpopular. In Congress, opinion is divided. Republicans are largely, though not uniformly, supportive of the war. Many Democrats, less so. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries urged Congress to act on a war powers resolution.
This is a matter of the utmost significance that the framers understood would perhaps be the most important decision that members of Congress would make. And in fact, they decided that in our system, they don't want a king-like figure being able to unilaterally decide to send American men and women to war. That's why in Article 1 of the Constitution, this power was explicitly given to the Congress. And it's now the Congress's responsibility to go on record, because Donald Trump has unconstitutionally and illegally chosen to launch a war.
Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia is on the Armed Services Committee, and he says he represents a pro-military state.
The question that Virginians and I think Americans are asking is, haven't we learned anything? Haven't we learned anything from 25 years in the wars in the Middle East? More than 14,000 U.S. troops and contractors killed, more than 65,000 troops and contractors injured, hundreds of thousands of civilian deaths, $8.2 trillion that could have been spent here at home, spent in wars in the Middle East, and what did we get out of it? That's what my military state is asking me.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Government Accountability Office has published numbers on how many employees left the Bureau of Indian Affairs during President Trump's first year in office. The BIA focused on reducing its federal workforce through layoffs and hiring freezes. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has details.
The 31-page report finds that more than 800 employees were gone by last July. That's roughly 11%. When such restructuring occurs, the BIA is supposed to notify tribes in advance.
Tribal leaders told us that the consultations happened after the staff reductions.
Anna Maria Ortiz is director of GAO's Natural Resources and Environmental Team.
It's resulting in the loss of a lot of institutional knowledge, and it's very hard for BIA to fulfill its mission.
The BIA did not offer a comment to GAO on its original report, but tells KJZZ it is committed to increasing efficiency, accountability, and support for tribal self-determination. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Since assuming his second term last year, President Donald Trump has leveled several executive orders that have affected Two-Spirits and the Native LGBTQ plus community. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
Trump's decree for federal agencies is to only recognize male and female as genders determined at conception. Trump has also banned gender-affirming care for youth. Elton Noswood is the executive director of the Two-Spirits and Native LGBTQ plus Center for Equity. He says as the White House began its onslaught against his community last year, he reached out to the National Congress of American Indians, which reactivated its Two-Spirit task force.
I had heard a community member express the frustration of why our people are not protecting us. Just that simple phrase really hit me and instilled some type of advocacy tactic to be able to begin to highlight the issues of how the Trump administration's executive orders were going to impact our communities.
Before colonization, Two-Spirits were accepted and even seen as sacred in many tribes. But over the past few centuries, Western attitudes have sparked intolerance and harassment against them and Native LGBTQ plus people. Noswood says resolutions from the NCAI help, as does carrying on events like the annual Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Powwow. Just being among community is healing, he adds. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
Western Washington communities are applauding the State House and Senate for including full wildfire prevention funding in their proposed budgets. Isabel Charlet has more.
The decisions honor a previous legislative commitment. Glenn Ellis Jr. is a board member of the Nature Conservancy and a member of the Macaw Tribe. The Macaw Reservation sits on the north end of the Olympic Peninsula, one of the rainiest places in the country. Ellis notes that while people rarely associate the peninsula with fire, recent years have proven otherwise.
3 years ago, we had two fires sprout up during November. It's just crazy to think that fire could spread in a place like this during that time. We get 119 inches of rain a year. We're a temperate rainforest.
Funds from what was known as House Bill 1168 that passed 5 years ago have helped 175 small forest landowners in three counties reduce wildfire risk through thinning and prescribed burns. I'm Isabel Charlet.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Suzanne Potter, Christopher Martinez, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.